January 13. And today, colleagues, we're discussing a couple of proposals, continuing on with our review of various election reform issues and dealing primarily with initiatives. And I've asked Representative Shetterly to come present to his to us a couple of his ideas that we see put together through HJR 8 and HJR 9. So with that, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I deeply appreciate your having scheduled these bills for hearing today and giving a chance to have an airing on this issue that's, I think, very important. For the record, I'm Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23.
And Representative Shetterly, before you, just to interrupt quickly, that we are going to consider this as a hearing on both HJR 9 and HJR 8, and just simultaneous hearing for now, just to make sure we can deal with this. And then also, there is one more issue to get through, and what I plan to do as we go look at House Bill 2378, which was sponsored by Representative Shetterly, is that after Representative Shetterly's presentations on 8 and 9 are completed, and after our questions are done, then we'll break that, do a quick public hearing for his testimony on 2378, then go back to 8 and 9 to deal with public testimony. So that's kind of where we're at.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Again, I appreciate the chance to be down here. Representative Williams, as you know, is a co-sponsor on 8 and 9 with me, and I want to express he wished very much that he could be here. He has a tiger by the tail upstairs in Judiciary Committee, hearing from the district attorneys and public defenders and other interested stakeholders in on the subject of indigent defense. And so I thought that he should probably be up there in that center ring. So I will take this one today. Just by way of background, I want to tell you what you have in front of you. One thing that you have is just an excerpt of a report from the National Conference of State Legislatures on the subject of initiative and referendum in the 21st century. I bring that to you because it's topical not only for these bills, 8 and 9, these resolutions that you're hearing today, but also I think some of the other issues that you have been considering. And it is the product of about a two-year NCSL work group that I was privileged to be a part of. We met around the country several times during the 2 years that we were working, and then presented this report endorsed by NCSL at the NCSL conference in Denver last summer. And I think it will give you a flavor of at least some of the broad themes in initiative and referendum and concerns, benefits, as well as challenges in the initiative and referendum system. So I think it will be very useful to you in your consideration of these resolutions, but also probably just generally as you look at issues relating to initiative and referendum. Also, what you have is dash two amendments of to HJR 8. I'll get to those in a minute. I'm going to deal with HJR 9 first. And then you have dash two amendments to HJR 9. I'll explain those, but really I'll explain them in the context of this flow chart that I think you also should have. Let me go back and say that in the work group on the NCSL task force, we met with people who are leaders on both sides of the issue around the country when it comes to initiative and referendum. One of them was David Broder, the journalist in Washington, D.C., who I think you would probably consider to be generally hostile to the initiative process. On the other side of the coin, we met with Dane Waters, who I've had the privilege to come to know over these past couple of years. And Dane is the director of the Initiative and Reform and Referendum Institute in Washington, D.C., which is very much an advocacy organization for the initiative and referendum process. And among all these disparate interests, one of the themes on which I would say there was agreement or consensus was that of the initiative process, probably the best was some form of what is called the indirect initiative. And it's hard to define that because it's different in the states that have it, but that is the process typically by which an initiative is routed through, at least to some extent, the legislative process before it gets to the ballot. And what that recognizes, I say again, this is consensus even with Mr. Waters from the Initiative and Referendum Institute, that's an appropriate way of dealing with an initiative, because it captures, I think, the best of both worlds. The initiative is good at raising issues that legislatures are disinclined to address, either because of political concerns or whatever the case may be. The initiative is good at raising those and saying, this is something that's important, we want you to deal with it. It is not so good necessarily at the intricacies of drafting and the problems that arise under unintended consequences, drafting errors, constitutional issues that in many cases don't even come into the discussion until after the initiative has been filed, signatures have been gathered, and the campaign is underway. And by that point, of course, the horse is out of the barn and down the road. And the initiative process has some problems in that area, where the legislature has a strength in our ability to work bills, to deal with compromise amendments, and to bring to play interests that have different perspectives so that we can better anticipate what some unintended consequences may be. And the indirect initiative process really has that benefit of bringing both of those strengths together. We don't have that in Oregon. We have the direct initiative, straight to the ballot, and that's the way it goes. And obviously we have seen in the last decade several frustrating circumstances where ballots of measures have been passed by initiative only to be overturned by the courts and the voters in their frustration wondering why they even bother when the courts undo this. And I think it leads to a general mistrust and frustration with the initiative process. HJR 9 would be a way by which we could not wipe the slate clean, because I think we're too closely tied to the initiative process here in Oregon to start from the beginning, but still merge some of the better elements of both the direct and indirect initiative process. And this flowchart really tells you how the measure works. It's easier to read than the bill. First of all, of course, it involves a constitutional amendment since it deals with the initiative process. The initiative is filed, and the initiative goes straight to the ballot, just in the usual way. Under HJR 9, there's no change in how the initiative gets to the ballot. I know you're dealing with ballot title shopping and other issues relating to that process, but HJR 9 doesn't speak to that. The initiative is filed, it's certified, it's circulated, and when it gets the requisite number of signatures for a constitutional amendment, because HJR 9 only deals with constitutional amendments by initiative, it goes to the ballot. Then on the ballot, you have not two choices, but three. Under HJR 9, we provide a third option for voters. Voters can vote yes, or they can vote no, or they have a third choice when the measure appears on the ballot, and that is to submit the measure to the legislature for consideration. This recognizes that in a lot of times you have campaigns where people, again, either drafting issues or questions about constitutionality that come up, or concerns about unintended consequences that were not fleshed out before the initiative hit the streets. And there is typically a group of people in a situation like that who would say, well, I like it. I like what it does. But I'm concerned that it's got some defects or some drafting errors or some other policy considerations that aren't fully addressed in this initiative and that need to be. And so for them, this option to submit basically is an option to say to the legislature, we think this issue is important for you to deal with. Get to work. And so the way this resolution is drafted, if more than 50% say yes, the measure is adopted. Simple as that. If the proponents of the campaign have the ability to persuade more than 50% of the people to say yes to an initiative to amend the Constitution, they win. If more than 50% vote no, the measure loses. But if neither yes or no gets a majority, then the measure is submitted directly to the next legislature for introduction and consideration. Then you have these options on the chart for the legislature. The legislature can reject or take no action. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Representative Miles Sanderson.
Thank you. I am a little bit confused on whether neither yes nor no. So there are 100% of, it'd be based on 100% of the voters that voted for this particular measure. I mean, not necessarily those who actually turned out
right.
for election, but just for this particular measure.
All right. Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence Anderson, yeah, so you might have some a measure that has 30% no, 30% yes, and 40% submit to the legislature. That one, you know, you're only counting the votes on that particular initiative. It goes to the legislature then. The legislature has these options. The legislature may take no action, either because it chooses not to or simply because it gets itself all tied up and can't take any action on the measure. If that happens, the measure goes back out to the ballot, unamended, to be voted on straight up and down, yes or no. That's a guarantee that the legislature can't just bury the thing in the bottom drawer of someone's desk. And so it's an assurance that this is not a hijacking of the initiative. If the measure comes to the legislature, if the legislature chooses not or is incapable of dealing with it, then the measure goes back out in the next election following the legislative session for a straight up and down vote, yes or no, and it passes or fails just like any initiative today. The legislature can, in fact, choose to re-refer the initiative and maybe endorse it in that process, in which case, again, the original goes back out straight to a vote up or down by the people. Or the legislature may refer an alternative measure, where through the process of committee hearings and testimony, the legislature recognizes either unintended consequences or constitutional problems or other issues, and then chooses to refer an alternative form of that measure back out to the people for a vote. If that happens, then under this resolution, again assuring that this is not a process of empowering the legislature to hijack the initiative process, that legislative alternative goes back on the ballot side by side with the original alternative, and the ballot is set up in such a way that you, kind of like your water district elections, you vote for one, you vote for one or the other. You can vote no, obviously, on both if you want. But that way, then, you have this, what we might hope would be a legislatively new and improved version of the measure, reflecting the same policy and the same subject matter that has been obviously of interest to the voters. And they, the voters then have the opportunity to adopt, if they choose, the legislatively modified alternative version of the measure. And there may be circumstances where the fourth option for the legislature would be, rather than refer it, it may be possible to simply enact it as an act. It may be something that is not necessarily required to be in the constitutions of the legislature, simply converts it from a constitutional amendment to a statute and enacts it. And the legislature could do that under an amendment that's actually not before you, but, oh, actually, no, it is, it is. And in that case, the original initiative would still go out, but with the provision that the chief petitioners could withdraw the initiative if they were satisfied that the legislature's action was sufficient with their interests. And so in broad strokes, that's what you have here. It's a process, you know, again, guaranteeing that in all circumstances, the legislature does not have the ability to hijack and bury a bona fide initiative that expresses the interest and the will of the people, but has the opportunity to weigh in on the process and hopefully in a constructive way to improve what ultimately might be voted on and enacted by the voters. Let me make some brief comments on HJR 8, and then I'll stop with the testimony. Were this to go out as a standalone referral from the legislature, the obvious chorus of questions from a skeptical public would be, what about you guys? Because the legislature has the ability, of course, to propose constitutional amendments by referral by a simple majority. And if you're going to make it harder for constitutional amendments to be enacted by initiative, shouldn't you take some of that same medicine yourselves? And HJR 8 says, yeah, we should. HJR 8 says that for the legislature to refer out a constitutional amendment to be voted on by the people, one of two things has to happen. Either it takes a three-fifths majority of both houses to pass out a referral in a single session of the legislature, or if the legislature is not able to amass that three-fifths majority, it takes a majority of the legislature in two succeeding legislative sessions in order to put that measure out on the ballot. Reflecting, I think, the sense that, again, when we're dealing with constitutional issues and amending the Constitution, it should either be something that has a strong level of support in the legislature, that's the three-fifths requirement, perhaps an emergency situation, something that needs to be acted on quickly, or it at least, if it, short of that, it at least should reflect more than just the priority of one session of the legislature, but should reflect something of a longer period of interest and concern and priority. And so that HJR 8 says we're willing to take the same medicine regarding the constitutional process, the process of amending the Constitution, as we are proposing in the initiative process. Those are your two. Let me just give you one example of a case in point where I know a state wishes they had this process. Florida, in the last election cycle, adopted a constitutional amendment mandating reduction in class sizes in their schools. Of course, for them, it was black and white. If you supported lower class sizes, you voted yes. If you didn't, you voted no. And it won by the slimmest of margins. It won by the very slimmest of margins. That measure, again, is constitutional. So it cannot be amended by the legislature, and it cannot be overlooked. That measure is estimated to have a fiscal impact over the next 7 years, as it rolls up to 2010, of $27 billion. That measure said expressly that local school districts would have no responsibility to pay for any of the cost of implementing the class size initiative. And that measure also did not bring any money with it to accomplish the class size reduction. And so it moved into the state constitution a $27 billion responsibility for class size reduction without any money or without even an opportunity to share that cost with local school districts. I can tell you that if a system like this were in place, people who really felt like they wanted to make a strong statement in favor of lower class size could vote to submit that to the legislature, say, we think this is important, you guys deal with it, and give the legislature then an opportunity to take that statement of public interest and support and deal with it in a legislative process that balances ways against means and responds to the to the people's wishes, but without necessarily assuming the full obligation that at this point is crippling Florida and their ability to budget and fulfill their other responsibilities. I bring this to you without any particular interest group or organization behind. This is offered to you as a proposal for your consideration for an improvement of the initiative process that is, I would say, pristine in the sense that it doesn't have an organization with a particular agenda or axe to grind behind it. It is. It's mine and Representative Williams, and so we offer it to you, to your good care and attention. And I thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Shirley?
I have a
Representative Berger.
Well, I'm very intrigued by it because I've been very frustrated by the number of things going into the Constitution, for one thing. But also, I'm wondering if with this process, would it help us screen out some of the things that have happened to us in Measure 11, where the impacts on the courts in the legislative process, that comes out many times? So will that help us? Because it still goes to the ballot, and the public still has an opportunity to vote. And I'm sure that there's some education that needs to be done, but as you know, the public sector doesn't have the funds to do campaigns, and they don't do campaigns. So Will it help us in that area?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, will it help? I think it will. Does it guarantee that you won't have the kind of outcome you're talking about? No, it doesn't. And again, that's respectful, I think, of the fact that, you know, for better or for worse, I think we need to recognize that Oregonians are very protective of their right in the initiative process to enact laws. And this says, basically, in the right case where this constitutional amendment is submitted to the legislature, because it doesn't get a straight yes or no vote on the first time around, at least let the legislative process have its go through the hearings process, through amendments, through public information, so that when this comes back to the ballot, ultimately, if that's what happens, if this initiative comes back to the ballot, at least there has been a maybe fuller discussion of the implications of the measure, and the public may be better educated by the time it comes around on that second vote under this. Now, does it guarantee that you won't have still an untenable outcome? Absolutely not, but, you know, we can't guarantee that. I think this increases the chances that we will have a more thoughtful process. And if there's a complaint, I'm sure, about this, it's that it makes it slower, that it makes it more expensive to amend the Constitution, and more difficult to amend the Constitution. But I guess my response to that is, when you're dealing with the Constitution, I'm not sure that ease and speed is necessarily the highest priority. Certainly at the federal level it's not. We know that.
Well,
in the process, if the legislature were to find that there are some changes that could be made that would be made, have it a much better process, and that's okay. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, yes. It can happen a couple of ways. The legislature can refer it an alternative version of the measure, in which case they both go out to the ballot. But the measure does expressly provide that once a measure has gone to the legislature and the legislature has taken action on it, the chief petitioners can withdraw their initiative. And so I think what that really does is it empowers chief petitioners to be representatives of the voice of the people as expressed in this measure on its way to the legislature. And so my hope is that in most cases you wouldn't have that outcome of competing measures on the ballot, but that rather you bring them into the process, and whatever the legislature does in the way of changes would be accepted by the petitioners. And either then, if it still has to go out to the ballot because it's a constitutional amendment, that it goes out by itself as a new and improved, everyone's on board kind of measure, or if it can be enacted statutorily, then simply it may not go out at all.
One final comment. In other words, when it goes to the legislature, the petitioners themselves have every ample opportunity to be a part of that process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, absolutely. Because if the legislature has the ability to deal with, to satisfy the concerns of the chief petitioners, then the chief petitioners have the capacity to withdraw that measure, and I think that would be a preferred outcome in just about every instance.
Okay. Representative Monis Anderson.
Let's go to HJR 8. And I just wanted to know the rationale, or maybe are there other states that have anything like HJR 8?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, yes, it's across the board. Some states do require votes by successive legislatures in order to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot. This one, again, recognizing that we're writing on a clean slate, we're amending the process that we already have, accommodates the ability to do both, to get it out in one session if there's that three-fifths majority in both houses, or then the other method of successive votes by simple majorities of two legislative bodies.
Can I follow up?
Yes, follow up.
You keep saying three-fifths, but in here it says two-thirds.
I'm sorry, two-thirds.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you. In various states, do they vary whether they have three-fifths, two-thirds, 50% plus one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, I'm going to guess that that's the case. I don't know precisely what the vote requirements are in different states.
And one further follow-up.
Follow-up.
I tend to like having the legislature need two-thirds votes, but then it's sort of inconsistent with what we submit to the public when we only need 50% point one or plus one. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, again, the purpose behind HGR 8 was to level the playing field between the initiative process and the referral in terms of the making the amendment a constitutional amendment a more thoughtful process. Sure, under HJR 9, there is still the ability to adopt an initiative by a simple, straight-up majority. But we are raising the possibility that in most cases it may actually not go as simply as that, but when you have the ability to vote that third option to submit it to the legislature, I would imagine that would be fairly attractive to a lot of voters. And so we're raising the prospects that it may take two votes to get most initiatives passed, ultimately, or at least a vote, and then a period of negotiation with the legislature. I see that as being functionally equivalent as raising the voting threshold requirement in the legislative process to get an amendment out in the first instance. It's not the same thing, but I think that in terms of what it does to the process of amending the Constitution by making it something that is going to take more thought, more time, more care and consideration, I think they both accomplish the same purpose.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shutterland, just to simplify, or you can follow me through this, this is a four-year process. Is that correct? It can't be a special session?
That's an interesting question, Mr. Chair, Representative Close. I think it does say the next regular session of the legislature. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, and frankly, if the committee were inclined to move on this, I think that would be an amendment worth considering if there was some reason or some felt need to call a special session to deal with an initiative. I certainly wouldn't be opposed to that.
And follow up?
Sure.
And is that what is meant by Section 1A, Section 2, Subsection 2, where you're repealing this section December 31st, 2006? Is that because of the four-year lead time to do this?
I'm sorry, Chair, was in a close for you?
Section 1A, subsection 2, it says this section is repealed December 31st, 2006.
I'm wondering. Close. Is that 8?
HJR 8.
HJR
8?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
No.
I'm sorry, are we on 9?
Well, we're
both.
We're
both.
Okay.
So, where are we?
Well, I'm just wondering in HJR 8, section 1A, subsection 2, it says this section is repealed December 31st, 2006, and so my question was, is that because of the lead time to implement this?
Yes, that is.
And one last question, if I could. Representative Cheryl, you said other states have successive votes on this type of thing, but this bill says consecutive, so my question is, in other states, are they consecutive sessions, or can they have voted 10 years ago and then they vote later?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Close, to my knowledge, the states that have the requirement, they are consecutive. They are immediately succeeding.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Shirley on 8 or 9?
Well,
sure, Representative Bonhart.
If I could, one of the answers that you gave to Representative Close's question about two consecutive regular sessions, wouldn't it be the case if a legislature wanted to contravene the idea of having two separate votes that they could under the rules that we currently have, they could vote at one session by a simple majority to adopt a constitutional amendment, adjourn, call themselves back into special session and pass the same thing again by a simple majority if the word regular was taken out here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we'd never do that. let me clarify my answer to Representative Close's question. When I heard Representative Close's question, I think I was hearing HJR 9, so that if you have an initiative, could the legislature convene in special session to deal with an initiative that's been referred to the legislature, been submitted to the legislature? And my response was, I think that would be a helpful amendment, so that if it was something that needed to be acted on quickly, that would speed that process through. I would not suggest that that same change is appropriate in HJR 8. In HJR 8, I think it should be votes in two consecutive regular sessions, so you don't have an invitation to that kind of manipulation.
I obviously misheard both question and answer. Thank you.
Anything further on 8 or 9? Okay, let me close the simultaneous hearing on 8 and 9 for a moment to now take on public hearing on House Bill 2378. And Representative Federley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief on this. I think you have some other witnesses lined up to testify. For the record, Wayne Shatterley, State Representative, District 23. This bill deals with a problem that you'll hear described from the counties as an unfunded mandate when the legislature schedules a special election, but does not provide funding to the counties to conduct the special election. And I think you'll hear testimony that, in fact, that has happened recently. And so this is intended to, and I think it was unintended, but this measure then is intended to clarify that if the legislature is creating a special election and imposing then the cost of conducting that on the counties, that it would be an expense of the state to reimburse the counties for that special election that they had no part in scheduling or calling themselves.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Federley? Okay.
All right. Thank you.
And for now, we will close House Bill 2378 public hearing. And
thank you very much. I appreciate
your
today.
Comments. And we will reopen the simultaneous hearing again on HJR 8 and HJR 9. And let's see. First, call Kathy Eaton. Oh. Kathy Eaton, it's your turn.
Representative Doyle, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the government chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And as you've heard me say already several times, the League is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed citizen participation in government and provides education services. Before addressing HJR 9, I would like to comment in general about the Oregon initiative process and proposed changes to it. The League conducted a year-long comprehensive study into the Oregon Initiative recall and referendum process 6 years ago. And we strongly reiterated as a result of that study the support for a direct democracy through an initiative system. We also discussed and adopted a list of possible changes to improve the process. Several proposals to amend the Oregon system have been introduced this session in both the House rules and the Senate rules. And we believe there is merit in discussing these proposals in a comprehensive way. The League is suggesting to you that the House and Senate Rules Committees gather together a package of the initiative reform bills, schedule a time when all of them can be examined, and after discussion determine which ones would be pursued. We believe this approach is better than scattered hearings and piecemeal consideration of related subjects and could result in initiative revisions that benefit to the public and to the direct democracy system. That being said, the League is speaking in support of HJR 9. Representative Shetterly disclaimed having any special interest group that would support or oppose this group. I have to tell him that 6 years ago we came to a strong agreement that the direct indirect initiative should be an option in Oregon's initiative system. And we believe that the use of the indirect initiative for both statute and constitutional amendment initiatives and the scheduling and discussion of qualified initiatives first on the agenda of the next legislative session, what I've been going to say to Representative Shetterly is that under the normal circumstances now, we vote on initiatives in the general election in the even-numbered years. The next legislative session is 2 months later, so that there really isn't any delay if, in fact, the people vote to have the legislature consider that particular initiative. There isn't a delay of any length of time, because it would come up on the agenda of the next legislative session, which would be the next January. Several of the 26 states which now allow the initiative process do have indirect initiatives. In fact, some immediately refer any initiative which qualifies for the ballot to the next legislative session without going to the voters first. In other words, any initiative that qualifies for the ballot does not go to the ballot. It actually goes to the next session of that legislature for consideration. So that particular step is bypassed. HJR 9 allows the electorate to decide whether to pass, reject, or refer an initiative law or amendment to the legislature. We suggest that there would be some concerted voter information, voter education, that would be needed to explain to the voters what is meant by this particular amendment. But the proposed amendment to the process could be beneficial, because referral to the legislature would provide a basis for public discussion on the issues in an environment more conducive to understanding the purpose of the measure than just the passion of campaign rhetoric. The bill does safeguard the intent of the initiative in mandating that if the legislature does not act, rejects, or drafts an alternative, the Secretary of State will put the original on the next general election ballot. The League believes HDR is a reasonable initiative revision, and we urge the committee to adopt it. Thank you.
Just a quick comment from the chair, at least, is that the League's admonition about what you consider piecemeal consideration, I would take exception to. We have bills that I think it's appropriate for this committee to hear, and you see this as a public hearing. We're not work sessioning this, or we've not work sessioned any other election reform bill at this point, except for one, and that was the emergency bill, basically, that the Secretary of State had requested. And I think, at least in my discussions on the record with the committee, was that we are taking the overview first, making sure we know what direction people want to go before we head in a direction on making some of these decisions and have some votes. I am concerned that there was a task force 2 years ago trying to deal with initiative reform, and for the hours that were put into that, they could not come to any kind of resolution. I believe it is up to the legislature to be making certain decisions, and we're going to be making them if it seems like there's the will to do it. And at this point, that's the direction I intend to continue on, which is to gather the information, make sure that my members on this committee have as much information as possible before making those decisions on which way we're going to go.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly what we're suggesting, is that before you make any decisions, everything is on the table, so you can really look and see what is actually being proposed to the system.
Well, maybe what
so we aren't disagreeing.
Maybe what you write and what you say ought to be in a little bit more concert. Any questions for Ms. Eaton? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Pamela Barndell.
I didn't bring any paperwork. I sent letters to the different representatives. As a person who tried to set forth an initiative, I found it very difficult to wade through the myriad of paperwork and legalities of it all. And the amount of signatures collected last year were 89,000 to change the amendment, and I just saw recently a little article in the paper that they've raised to 100,000. I wondered how that happened really fast. I see this as impeding the democratic process for the people, and monetary issues, what it will cost. There already is computer discussion for those who are for or against the process, the initiative set forth. I'm just very concerned that this is a tightening the noose around the initiative process for the person who wants to set initiative forth. That's just my concerns, just as general person from the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Dave Honeycutt, I'm going to bring you forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. This seems to be initiative day at the Capitol. There are initiative bills up in Senate rules at 3 o'clock. I've actually spent more time preparing testimony for those that particular bill than I have for HJR 8 or 9. But I am here to testify in opposition to HJR 9. And take exception to one of Representative Shetterly's comments. I don't believe, personally, having been involved and been around lurking in the halls of the Capitol for quite some time now, and also been involved in the initiative process, that the decisions and the bills that come out of this body are any more thoughtful than some of the initiatives that are proposed and placed on the ballot directly by the people. The legislation is certainly more political, but on the other hand, bills that I've seen come out of this body, including bills that we've been involved in, don't always result in what I would consider to be good public policy. So, with that, I hate to see direct democracy impeded upon, and I think this bill does that. Under HJR, under existing law, the legislature already has the ability to refer essentially whether you call it a companion initiative or a competing initiative, the legislature already has the ability to do that. That was done, I believe, in 2000 or in the 99 session with measures 88 and 89, as I recall, the full deductibility versus the partial deductibility that the legislature sent out. And that's also been done at the local level. We had a Metro Charter Amendment that was up. Metro read the tea leaves, realized that our measure was going to pass, and referred out a competing measure, which was then adopted by the people. So the legislature already has the ability to do that. We don't think that HJR 9 is necessary. And like I say, being involved in both processes, I would hate to see anything that would weaken the people's ability to control the Constitution. The Constitution is the document of the people, and if the people want the ability to amend their Constitution, they ought to have the right to do so.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Honeycutt? Oh, Representative Berger.
I agree with you. Of the people, by the people, and for the people, and I consider myself one of the people. Is there anything in the process, however, that would deter the vote of the people? In other words, if the people approve it, it goes nowhere except becomes law. So there's not anything in that process or do you think it does? Maybe that should be my question. Do you think there's anything in that process that impedes the democratic process of the voice of the people?
Well, Chair Doyle, Representative Verger, there is quite a number of steps in the existing initiative process before, from the time that somebody comes up with an idea to the time that it actually gets put on the ballot. Many of those steps, including the preparation of the ballot title and the fiscal impact, the fiscal impact statement report, I think are in need of reform. HJR 9 doesn't really get at that idea, and I realize and respect Chair Chair Doyle's admonition to the last witness, but I would also, I also think, and I've actually talked to Representative Williams about this, I would also think that this, it would be appropriate before we go down the road on any of these particular pieces of legislation to see if there's common ground. There may be common ground amongst all the groups and, of course, the legislature as well, to make some changes, but I wasn't involved in the process last session, so I don't know, you know, I don't know what was discussed, but would certainly be willing to do that again, if that's possible. From my experience, it is darn difficult to put a measure on the ballot. I've been there and done that. And so measures that make it more difficult, like HJR9, I just won't support, and our organization won't support.
Mr. Chair. Okay, so I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. You believe that there's some reform that's necessary, but you believe this is also redundant.
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, I don't believe that HJR9 is a proper method of reforming the initiative process. I would like to see some changes to the initiative process. One of the changes that we would like to see and we'll have a bill to this effect, is a measure that eliminates the ability of people to go in after the election, after the people have approved an initiative, and raise a procedural challenge to that initiative, argue that it violates the full text provisions of Article 4, argue that it violates the separate votes provisions of Article 7. We'd love to see an end to essentially forcing the Oregon Supreme Court to overturn the will of the voters. If those challenges need to be made, they ought to be made prior to the time that the people actually get the opportunity to vote on those measures. That's a reform that I think is necessary, and of course, to the extent that other groups have other ideas, it may be appropriate to sit down as quickly as we can and discuss those.
Okay. I have one final comment, Mr. Chairman. My reason for pursuing it with you is, first, to better understand you, but I grew up in a state that did not have the initiative and referendum, and I think that states with the initiative and referendum are very, very fortunate.
Other questions for Mr. Honeycutt? Okay, great. Thank you. And batting cleanup on McIntyre, Eric Winters.
Okay. Representative Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Don McIntyre. I'm from Gresham, and I nominally represent, or I am the president of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I want to make this cautionary note about myself. I hope you don't think me too flip, but my gorge rises on this particular topic, so there's a tendency for me to speak in an inflammatory way. I'll try to resist that. But since it is Initiative Amendment Day down in the Capitol, and there will be more of it, I'm sure, I would just like to reflect on a few generalities to ask my legislators to think in constitutional terms. And Representative Verger reflected on government of the people, by the people, for the people. That's a great expression, but one of the greatest constitutional statements is in the Oregon Constitution. It's the very first thing in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, and it says that all power is inherent in the people. Everything springs from them, and by the way, in Article 1 it says they have the power to alter, change, or even abolish the government in any way they see fit. Now, fortunately, we don't have to use any means possible, because Article 4 of the Constitution says something equally as inspiring. It says that the people shall have the right to create legislation or refer legislation from the legislature. That was installed in the Constitution at the turn of the century simply as a statement that, look, we want the legislature to do day-to-day work for us, write laws, do the busy work of government. But sometimes when it comes to the really big stuff, we want to be included in it. And that's what Article 4 is about. The one thing that I've noticed about the legislative process when it tends to do reform, initiative reform, the reform always works to enhance the power of the government and diminish the role of the people in the process. I would like once, sometime, I would like to have Representative Shetterly or Representative Williams call me and ask me what I think reform ought to look like. There are some arguments for some forms of reform, but it has to be the kind of reform that does not diminish the power of the people. Now I just will reflect on a few anecdotal things. Representative Shetterly, in making his case for HJR 9, said he implied that this is the building where we have advice and consent, and we can discuss and debate the minutiae of law and really consider it. Let me refute that just with an example, or a couple of examples. I can remember when I first got interested in Oregon politics, this body passed a law that made it so contractors had to guarantee their home building work for 10 years. The legislature voted for it. They adjourned, and it turned out that that was such a stupid idea that they had to reconvene in special session to undo it. The author, of course, was punished by was being sent to the U.S. Congress. That was less a coin. But even more recently, and I was intimately involved in this. I'll just give you three statistics. The number of words in ballot measure 5 is around 950 words. Then along came measure 47, which would have added some limitations to the property tax limitation established by measure 5. There was a flaw in it in measure 47. But measure 47 had 2,100 words. I'm just saying this parenthetically. There was an ambiguity in measure 47 that could have been settled by the courts. No harm, no foul. If the court would have ruled on the more on the side of the government, well, live with it or come out with another initiative. But instead, the legislature said, you know, measure 47 could be fixed. We will simplify and clarify it. This body did that. I'll never forget it. Their simplification and clarification of a 2,100-word amendment came out to 4,700 words, and no one, I defy anyone to understand it. It's in our Constitution right now. It was considered by this body, start to finish, 18 days. I would like to know, for example, Representative Shetterly talked about unintended consequences. I wonder if anyone in this building knew that, for example, Measure 50 would unleash the urban renewal genie again, let it out of the bottle. And that's cost millions and millions of dollars. That was not the intent of Measure 47, so that was a legislative clarification of what the people had passed. There's another interesting thing where HJR 9 gives us an option of you can vote yes, no, or you can vote to refer it to the legislature. And when Representative Shetterly gave you an example, he said, for example, there could be 30% yes, 30% no, and 40% send it to the legislature. I would say that's a shaded example, because I could give you another one. 49% yes, 49% no, 2% sending it to the legislature, and that's where it goes. Now, one other thing about the legislature's involvement in the people's business, there is a lot to talk about. He referred to the courts taking initiatives and revisiting them and saying that they are incorrect. Well, that's up to the perspective of the people who observe these things. We have an extremely partisan court system. The courts, I can say this without equivocation, the courts can't stand the initiative process. And that court decision, particularly on ballot measure 7, was an abomination. The reason I bring that up is that we need to insulate our initiative process from that kind of mischief making, and HJR 9 does not do it. So let me put it this way. Representative Shetterly, and I assume Williams, says that this is representative government. We reflect the will of the people. They elected us to do that. Let me question that. The reason the legislature is not necessarily reflective of the will of the people, it's the nature of the people that run for the legislature. By running for the legislature, you set yourself apart. Nothing wrong with that. But you're the kind of people that have enthusiasms, political views, that take you kind of out of that statistical mix that makes you the cross-section of the community. And here's my prima facie evidence of that. The citizens wanted property tax relief and went to the ballot 6 times. Now, the last time it was approved, it was a close vote, 52-48. That was ballot measure 5. Now, it seems to me that if the legislature was reflective of the will of the people, at least half the legislature would have supported ballot measure 5, but that wasn't it. The people in office were uniformly 100% against ballot measure 5. I can give you an even more extreme example, and that's the sales tax. This august body decided time after time after time that the people really wanted a sales tax, and they'd refer it out, and then it would get beat 3-4-1. So that's a cautionary tale about whether or not the legislature should absorb more of the citizens' rights. I got a lot more I could say, but I don't need to. You know where I stand, and I beg you not to mess with the initiative process. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Eric.
Good afternoon, Representative Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Eric Winters. I'm an attorney. Part of my practice is in the initiative process. And I almost hesitate to add anything after Don's comments. But I would want to make one observation, and I've just picked up HJR 9. I came down here for testimony on a different initiative gutting proposal. But the introduction of the initiative and referendum process was designed to give the people an opportunity to debate legislatively intractable issues. If you look at the things that have come through the initiative process, especially when it comes to amending the Constitution, we have things like term limits, we have the death penalty, tax reform issues, things that never really make it through the legislature. The practical effect of this, by giving people a third choice, HJR 9, is to induce voter laziness. Right now, people have to wrestle with what these measures mean. And if they don't understand them, their typical reaction is to vote no or not to vote at all. Now there's an opportunity to punt it back to the legislature, and I think you'll have a lot of people choosing to do that. This is a disincentive to voters to learn and understand the mechanics of the initiative process, and I urge you all to vote against it.
Okay, questions? Representative Moss-Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, both of you, but especially my constituent. I agree with you that the power of the people, we need to make sure we preserve the power of the people. But when we have initiatives that are now becoming so close, the 48-52 I think is very close, and even your example of 49-49 so close, to me, I'd like your input on how do you think, if it's so close and there's such polarity there, that why do you think that the legislature just that third choice would diminish the power of the people? I don't see that yet.
Because Representative Lawrence Anderson, I can see, for example, I'm involved, as you know, for years in politics in a very practical sense, and the deadly enemies of my political perspective are the unions, particularly the public employee unions. They have an enormous amount of power because they have all kinds of cash, money that they've extracted from government employees' checks, and then they use it for political purposes. It would take very little effort on their part to take folks who don't think much about voting, the so-called independent, which often means indifferent, galvanize that a small group of those into frustrating an up or down vote by the people. Measure 5 passed by a very close margin, and so that's the kind of close vote that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, remember that the legislature has the power to refer out repeal of Measure 5. It hadn't been done, and it'd be a wild campaign, I imagine. It'd be instructive, and my guess is that it would do better than it did in its original form, because taxes are a very significant issue. I may just take this moment to run an idea past you if we're talking about reform. One of the complaints about the initiative process is, do we need all this stuff in the Constitution? And without indicting the legislature again, most of the junk in there came from the legislature. The legislature refers more stuff out than people initiate. But the reason that the citizens go to put things in the Constitution is so it won't be undone by the legislature. And there's a good example. By 10-1, the people approved homeowners and renters relief in 1980, I believe it was, and also there was a, well, the kicker was in there, and a spending limit. This body instantly ignored the spending limit because it's statute, and you have plenary power, and you just, not you specifically, but the legislature invented exceptions, so the spending limit has never applied. That's why citizens want to put stuff in the Constitution, because they don't trust the legislature. Now, here's an idea. Why not refer out a bill that if it passed, a constitutional amendment that says, if the citizens initiate a statute and it's approved, the legislature can't touch it for, say, 5 years. If there's something in it they don't like, they can refer that out. But give the people 5 years to have their statute to prove or not its efficacy. And if it's really bad, simply refer it out and let the citizens make the amendment. But that way, you can keep probably a lot of attempts at putting things into the Constitution on that basis. I'm wearing out my welcome to the thing.
Well, if you just weren't so shy and we have to draw this out of you, John. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. That concludes the public hearing on HR 8 and HR 9. And we will reopen public hearing on House Bill 2378 and call Al Davidson forward.
Thank you, Chair Doyle. Members of the committee, for the record, Al Davidson, Marion County Clerk, today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Representative Shetterly essentially outlined the very simple premise behind House Bill 2378. And the bill is designed to put into statute what has been the practice of the state of Oregon for many, many years, and that is that when a state calls a special election, the state pays for that election. We've seen that happen recently in September when the legislature called a special election. We conducted the election. The counties have been reimbursed or in the process of being reimbursed for the cost of conducting that election. There was some reference to an unfunded mandate, and that is the issue, I guess, with the January special election. No provisions were made to pay for that, although we're not expecting to have a great deal of problem with that when amount of that election is presented to Ways and Means Committee. It's historically been the practice of the state to do this. It's something that has been not included in the statutes. We believe it should be, since it is the practice, and therefore we asked that House Bill 2378 be drafted, and we are here to support that. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Ms. Davidson? Sure. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In the bill, is there any limitations on how many special elections there can be in a cycle, in a year, that would have to be funded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, there are not. If the legislature called multiple elections on dates other than primary and general elections, then the legislature would be responsible for those costs, and that's been the historic practice.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Al, I certainly agree with you, certainly philosophically, with the intent of the bill. Do you have any idea or any estimate of, say, some previous elections, what the state might have had to pay to reimburse county clerks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Backlund, the question actually is what the state did pay to reimburse, because that has been done. From the Secretary of State's office, I have the numbers from the September 2002 special election. The cost of that election to the counties was $1,169,000 and some change. That amount is the amount that the state is reimbursing the counties, and the reimbursement is really somewhat of a misnomer, because we use the same formula that we use when we conduct elections for special districts or cities or the other. In my county, we conduct elections for 70 some different districts, and we are not allowed to charge any of our regular full time staff. The basis is that those people are there anyway for voter registration and the other functions that we have. So we only charge out the additional cost for conducting that election. So there are some rather strict guidelines as to what we can charge, and the state of Oregon, I have to admit, does a very good job of auditing those costs. I've been on the phone a number of times with questions that they had about our September billing that we submitted. So I think you can be assured that there's no intent here to rip off the state. It's only to recover the costs that are absorbed by the county to perform the election that the state has called.
Thank you.
And I think to follow in that same vein, I mean, whenever we authorize a special election, I mean, we're told what the cost is to do that, but it sounds like that cost is really just to the state, maybe for voters' pamphlet for getting the thing scheduled, but it's, I guess there's some costs that the counties are bearing that...
The costs that I mentioned that we're talking about here are exclusive of the voter pamphlet costs. It's the cost to us. Because we're not conducting an election then anyway, as we are in a primary and general election, it's the cost of printing the ballots, it's the cost of distributing the ballots, it's the cost of counting the ballots, and doing all of those things that are necessary to conduct an election.
Anything further, Mr. Davidson? Great, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I had Pamela Barndell signed up, but I think she's gone. Paul Snyder, AOC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we concur with the testimony of Al Davidson and Representative Shetterly. We believe that this legislation is consistent with prior practice of the state, and it's consistent with our understanding of the current law. It's consistent with the constitutional provision which Representative Cherilly cited, and we support the legislation.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Snyder? Very well. Thank you. Okay, members, that concludes then the public hearing on House Bill 2378, and we are we're through with our work today. We do have a hearing scheduled for both Tuesday, Thursday next week, and we'll be getting the agenda out on that tomorrow, and then I think at this point we're just going to continue through with some of the bills that have been assigned to the committee and kind of see how things unfold. But I think after the next couple of weeks we're going to start seeing things just heat up a little more as more bills are coming our way, basically in anticipation of having committees starting to shut down in May. We're looking basically March and April to conclude most of our work on election reform and a few of the other issues that are being directed to us. Before then, we move on into the taking over what the other committees will be sending us as they shut down. So, you know, and just putting that in context of meeting twice a week for the 2 hours that... Yeah, that really doesn't give us a whole lot of meeting time before things start picking up. So, with that, we will adjourn.